All right, now, chapter 10, much more interesting chapter, much more important for us, because what's going on in this question, this chapter, is the question about the identity of Jesus. And we're faced with some interesting things. Now, common view, especially among what we would call liberal interpreters of the New Testament, would be to say that Jesus had no concept of his godness. It kind of developed slowly. This is sort of what you see in some of the Jesus movies. This is what you get in Jesus Christ Superstar. I know I'm dating myself. I still listen to it on occasion. I like the music. Theology, not so much, but the whatever. So in Jesus Christ Superstar, you have Jesus kind of figuring out who he is and kind of coming to these conclusions, and Judas not liking the way things are developing and kind of getting soured on the whole thing. And that's a pretty common take on this. What is Stein's argument in this chapter about Jesus and his self-understanding? He knew himself to be Messiah and God the whole time. This is important. Yep.
Well, wasn't young child account that Luke has really kind of bring that to light?
Yes, exactly. Because you have Jesus in the temple, I have to be about my Father's business. He knows who he is already. Now, how much the human part is, you know, being caught up to speed and when, who knows? And this is pure speculation. We really have no business guessing about what Jesus knew when, and it's all we can do is guess, and there's really no point in doing that. But you have to kind of wonder about, you know, did Jesus at 3 years old know everything, or did the human, you know, nature know enough that it could handle things as he was going along? And, you know, I don't know how it plays out. But see, this even gets back to our discussion about the baptism. What's the significance of the baptism? This is God claiming Jesus. And it's not only for the sake of the onlookers, but even more, it's for Jesus himself, according to his human nature. God is my Father. That's right. And this is the affirmation. That's a good thing. Because the human nature is human nature in Jesus, the real deal. All right. Now, so we go forward, and the point here then we're going to make again and again is Jesus knew who he was. His self-understanding is there. He knows himself to be Messiah. All right, the big thing that's going on, though, is the question is, what about the disciples, and how do they get this? And they're going to talk about that next chapter when we get to Caesarea Philippi. But for now, we want to think about Jesus himself and his self-understanding, what he knows about himself. And Stein's argument is Jesus knew himself to be Messiah, and he knew himself to be fully God. And there are three areas of evidence that show this. Now, why this matters is because this is not a moot point anymore. And you're going to meet people in your parish who are going to have Jehovah's Witness and Mormon friends, and they're going to challenge exactly this kind of thing. This is the Jehovah's Witness number one point of attack. Jesus never claimed to be God. The idea of Jesus' godness was made up by, in 325 AD, Council of Nicaea forced it on Jesus. Jesus would have been horrified to think that he was being called God. That's the JW take on this. And they say there's nowhere in the New Testament where Jesus says he's God. And then they do, of course, their fast and loose interpretations and their little careful translations. But they would argue there's only a couple verses we have to worry about anyway. Stein's argument is incredibly different, because what Stein is saying is, no, every page of the New Testament screams it, and the Gospels scream it. And that's why this chapter matters, and I want you to pay attention to what's going on here, because Stein says we can put the evidence in three categories. First one is what Jesus did. His actions. All right, so the first area is Jesus' actions, what he did. So what did Jesus do? Well, we have this kind of two things. First of all, he goes around forgiving sins. Now, we're kind of used to that. We're used to a pastor standing in front of the church and saying, I forgive you your sins. Of course, he's always doing that. Why? Because he is a called and ordained servant of the word, right? And by the authorization of Christ, he forgives sins. We're used to that. But in Christ's day, this was kind of a weird thing. And so when the paralytic comes down through the roof and Jesus says, I forgive you your sins, the reaction of the Pharisees is exactly what we would expect. What are you doing? You can't do that. Only God gets to forgive sins. That's blasphemy. But Jesus does it. And then to kind of put the icing on the cake, he says, well, which one's harder anyway, to say I forgive your sins or to tell the guy to get up and walk? It's obviously forgiving sins, but just to make a point, go ahead and walk home. All right. So the guy gets up and goes. And Jesus is like, whatever. And the real message is, hey, I can do this. I can do this. I can forgive sins. And then we have these miracles. And Stein says we've got at least 34 separate miracles going on here in the New Testament of Jesus doing things. And the most important ones, and they're all kind of the same way, but the things that really stand out are these explicit miracles in nature. And think about this for a minute. Gospel of Mark, you've got Jesus asleep in the back of the boat on the cushion. Mark adds a little detail. And then the sudden storm whips up on the Sea of Galilee, seas in a frenzy, and the disciples, most of them seasoned fishermen, are coming unglued. We're going to die. This is it. Now, for seasoned fishermen who have spent their life on the Sea of Galilee to say, this is it, we're going to die, must be some storm. All right? So it's a pretty significant thing. So last straw, what are we going to do? Wake up Jesus. Hey, Jesus, we're all dying here. We want you to be aware of this fact so you can die like the rest of us. You know, we don't want you to miss out. And so they wake him up. Honestly, they're not waking him up hoping he can do anything. They're just waking him up. We're perishing. Don't you care? How can you be asleep? And now here's where the really cool thing happens. So Jesus says, where's your faith? Come on, guys, get your act together. And then, peace, be still. Not only does the wind stop, but we have flat lake. Now, you should think about this a little bit. Mark's really clear on this. Immediately, there was a great calm. This is awesome. So you have flat lake, no wind, just like that. Now the disciples are really freaked out. Because who can do this? Only God. This is exactly the point. And the disciples know it. They know it. That's why they ask rhetorically, who is this man? Who does this? Even the wind and the sea obey him. And there's only one answer, and they know it. This is not some kind of rhetorical question. They know what's going on here. Jesus is God. But they can't quite get it all together yet. Now, we're going to talk about this even more next week when we get into Balcom. It's hot stuff. You guys just can't wait, I know. So, his actions. What kind of actions is God doing? He's doing God stuff all the time. He does God stuff. The stuff only God can do. And this is the whole point of the Gospel of Mark and all the Gospels, is the disciples are being pulled along, and there's just this increasing pile of evidence that finally kind of pushes them over the top to say, you're Christ, the Son of the living God. We'll get there in the Caesarea Philippi in a minute. So Jesus' actions, first category. What's the second category? Jesus' words. Jesus' words. So, does Jesus say things which give evidence of his self-understanding? All the time. How does he teach? This is the thing that Matthew marvels at. He taught them as one with authority, not as the scribes and the Pharisees. Because how do the rabbis and the scribes teach? Well, somebody said, they taught the way we do. Quote Luther, quote Walther, well, quote Chemnitz, quote Pieper, quote somebody. You know, well, Walther says, or Luther says, or Tertullian says, and we find stuff in the church fathers, and if we can find it in the fathers, hey, we're home free, and this is all good. But Jesus, he dispenses with all that. He doesn't care what somebody has said. He says, you've heard it said, but I say to you. And then Stein introduces how important the word amen is in this. Verily, truly. You see, this amen was not kind of floating around and using all the time. Jesus starts using this one. I say to you, truly, this is it. So he speaks from his own authority. And Stein points out very nicely that one of the attractions of Jesus was his teaching. People were coming to him not just because of the miracles, but because he was an extraordinary teacher. The way he did it, what he said, the fact that he taught with his authority, whoa, it was just blowing them away. And by the way, and a little aside, help this to be a motivation for you in your own ministry. When you teach, teach with authority. Guys, okay? Don't get up there and, you know, lead a Bible class and say, oh, what do you think, Albert? Okay, that's your opinion. Okay, oh, Margaret, what do you think? Okay, all right, okay, next verse. Come on, teach them something. People want you to be their pastor, which means speak with an authoritative word. It's obviously based on not your opinion, but based on what's there, but teach with authority. That's one of the attractions. Jesus, he's saying what is, because, and he's saying it with confidence, because it's not his idea, but it's the way it is. With Jesus, it is his idea, because he's God. And so that's another thing. Jesus' words, he's teaching with God's authority. And it's not derived. Unlike the Old Testament prophets, he never says, thus saith the Lord. Never says. He just says, I say to you. It's first person singular stuff. And then Stein wraps this up very nicely here on page 145. And this is reminiscent of C.S. Lewis from Mere Christianity. When C.S. Lewis has that famous passage where he's saying Jesus was either liar, lunatic, or Lord. You guys are familiar with that? Okay, the nice alliteration from Lewis. Well, Stein kind of follows that here. The totalitarian nature of Jesus' demand for allegiance must not be lost sight of or compromised. To require loyalty greater than that due father or mother, wife or children is to demand the kind of allegiance that only God can make. In light of all this, one cannot avoid the questions, who is this who thinks that the world revolves around himself? It's right. A deranged egomaniac, a false prophet, or can it be that this is indeed the King of Kings and Lord of Lords? It's exactly right. Jesus says crazy stuff, unless he's God. Well, then it all makes sense. But if he's not, it's like, what is this? All right, third category, titles of Jesus. And what's most important here are the ones that Jesus chooses for himself, his self-chosen titles. And we have three that he's going to explore. The first one is going to be Son of God. And then he's going to talk about the Messiah title. And then Jesus' favorite, the Son of Man, are going to be the three titles Stein's very interested in. Now, Son of God, you would think that's kind of like over-the-top claim for divine identity. But not so much. Why? Yeah, Old Testament used it a lot, referring to Israel as the Son of God, or to angels being sons of God. And so it's not quite as crystal clear as you might want, but it's really not as useful. Messiah is also interesting. We talked about this a little bit last time. What's Messiah actually mean? The anointed one. And so this just means kind of God's chosen special one. But does Messiahship necessitate divinity? No. Again, this is one of the things that's kind of odd for us because being Christians, we're raised thinking Messiah equals God. No, 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 no. And this is something you have to be careful with your people to help them realize. To claim Jesus as Christ or Messiah is to make a statement about his role, but it's not saying anything about his identity per se. Okay? And so his divinity is a different issue. Son of Man is really fascinating because it has this ambiguity toward it, and that's intentional. So in other words, this is intentionally ambiguous. And I know that's exactly why you guys use ambiguous language in your papers. You're trying to be intentional about it, right? Sometimes this works. In fact, when you write sermons, sometimes a little ambiguity goes a long way. It's very useful. But that's the situation here with this Son of Man. And it goes on two levels. On one level, Son of Man can be just very innocuous. Son of Man, human. That's right. Jesus is a human. Safe, no big deal. And so Jesus could say, the Son of Man, self-referentially, and people would say, yeah, okay, whatever, interesting kind of colorful language. You're just talking about yourself, a human being, fine. But then, for those who have the eyes to see it, there's a whole other level, right? We have the references in Daniel and Ezekiel where the Son of Man is this chosen one, this Messiah, and the Son of Man is even taking on roles which only God can do. And so it's a little bit like a parable, where the parable is couching this teaching in kind of hidden language that most people don't get, but if you have the faith or the eyes of faith to see it, then you say, ha-ha, there's more going on here. I get it. And same kind of thing with Son of Man. The average person could kind of dismiss it as whatever, it doesn't mean much, but the person who has faith to say, Son of Man, you know it, Son of Man. The whole Daniel thing, that's who Jesus is. And so it's very latent, and very pregnant title with lots of strong overtones. All right, and that's the idea here. We also need to remember and be careful because why is it that Jesus is somewhat hesitant to take the claim of Messiah and use that for himself? It's got so many overtones. And it's got militaristic, it's got political overtones. And this is not to fault anybody. It's not to say the disciples were too stupid to figure it out. No, they're products of 400 plus years of ingraining this teaching. You know, the Messiah, he's going to be the political leader. So when the disciples are thinking political Messiah, who can fault them? And they weren't able to get past this very easily. In fact, they spend 3 years, or 1.5 to 3.5 years, with Jesus. And they're immersed in his teaching. And yet, even at the ascension, they're still asking him, now? Now are you going to establish your kingdom? Do we get the thrones now? We're waiting for that. And he has to say, come on, guys. No, not yet. So there's still, even after the resurrection, it's still not as clear as it should be. We would want it to be. So it takes a long time to undo this assumption they have about what Messiah means. And this, frankly, accounts for Mark's messianic secret. You guys are familiar with that, of course. Or in the Gospel of Mark, Jesus does a miracle. And people say, oh, you're the Messiah. Jesus says, yeah, go and tell all your friends. No. He says, shh, don't tell. And of course, they do. But he's trying to keep a lid on it. And this always kind of perplexed people. Oh, we're supposed to tell everybody. How can we tell them to be quiet? And the reason is, best answer, because of this whole wrong ideas. And from a very human standpoint, he needs to keep a lid on things for a little bit. Now, you might say, no, but he's God. He knows how it's going to play out. Yeah, but there's the human aspect to it. And so he doesn't want this to move too quickly. And we see this really being played out with the feeding of the 5,000, when they're going to come and make him king by force, and he has to dismiss them. And he even dismisses the disciples first because he doesn't want them part of this, because he knows they're going to get caught up in it too. And so he has to resist this and kind of keep a lid on it until, when does he finally accept the title? Palm Sunday. Palm Sunday, he finally accepts the title because now it's time. D-Day has arrived. H hour is here. It's time. The hour is
Look
come.
How fast they killed him after he took the title.
Exactly. And so, well, it's all coming to a head anyway, but you're right. So at this point, all the gloves are off, out it comes, and he's ready to go with it. That's right. But until then, there's work that needs to be done first before the whole thing comes out. All right. Good. Anything else here from this chapter? From chapter 10. All right. Now, having talked about this, we can begin to see even more clearly why chapter 11 is significant here, this events of Caesarea Philippi. Because what finally comes together at Caesarea Philippi? Anybody? What's the big moment? Well, okay, this is Gentile land, and the question has always been, what's Jesus doing up there? And Stein explores that, and he dismisses all the possible things. This is a Gentile mission. Well, if it's a Gentile mission, it's not very successful. And, you know, why is he always kind of holding back? And so that probably doesn't account for it. And I think Stein's on the right track. Why is Jesus up here? To teach. He wants to be undistracted. He needs time with his disciples. He wants to teach them. And we get the big final moment where they're having the conversation. Ah, who do people say I am? Wow, Jesus, you should hear the stories going on about you. Some people think you're, you know, John the Baptist come back. Some people think you're Elijah. Other people think, you know, some prophet. And, you know, they're all kind of talking. And then the big question comes, what about you? Now, speculation time, but if you're going to make a movie, this is a great moment. Because now all the banter dies off instantly, and the crickets are chirping, and there's this long, protracted silence. And then finally, somebody speaks. Any question about who it's going to be? And so Peter, of course, opens his mouth, and this time manages to keep his foot out of it, and says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And it's like at that moment, ding, 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 you know, everything, whoop, whoop, all the bells go off. That's it. This is exactly the moment Jesus has been waiting for and prepping for, because now he's got it. This is the confession. They've got it. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. So not only have they come to terms with Messiah, they were probably ready for that a long time ago, but they're even going one better up, Son of God. That's it. So they're getting it. It's there. And what's fascinating is, what's the very next word out of Jesus' mouth? And this Messiah is going to have to die and suffer. And then Peter does put his foot in his mouth, because Peter's like, nope, wrong, Jesus. You're forgetting about Messiah. Messiahs don't die. Messiahs fight Rome. And let me clarify this, Jesus. You're missing something here. Maybe you weren't in synagogue that week when they were talking about that. The Messiah doesn't die, Jesus. And he's dead serious. He's going to straighten Jesus out. And it's interesting because the Greek is very strong. You know, Peter actually rebukes Jesus. You know, no, you're wrong about that. And of course, the whole point is Jesus has to re-educate these guys. They're just not there. But what's even more important, though, is from Jesus' perspective, what's going on. As soon as he has this confession from the disciples' mouth, now everything turns. And now, from this time forward, he's heading south with one goal, Jerusalem and the cross. And if you put this into the timing of things, when does Caesarea Philippi happen? The winter, right before the spring of the crucifixion. So we're four months out. So when you think about the timing of this, it's tied on. I mean, when you're reading the Gospels, the Transfiguration and Caesarea Philippi usually happen right about in the middle of the Gospel. And then you've got a couple chapters to get south to Jerusalem, then you've got all the Passion Week. And you get the idea that's kind of about halfway through. But in reality, it's right towards the end. I mean, it's right on top of it. So you have the Caesarea Philippi, you have the Transfiguration, then you have Jesus, Luke says, setting his face like flint, and off he goes. He's heading for Jerusalem. Nothing's going to stop him. All right? So this is a huge point. And that's why Stein calls this the turning point. Stein's right on the money here. I think he's got this right, and he does a good job with this. He puts it, all the stuff at Caesarea Philippi, and then Stein puts Transfiguration on Mount Hermon. Again, big debate, who knows, who cares. If you go to the Holy Land, the pilgrim driver, the tour operator for you and your pilgrimage is going to pop you down in different hills, and whatever is convenient is going to become the Transfiguration Hill because he wants you to feel good about it. But they usually take you to Tabor, not usually to Mount Hermon. That's too far up north. But probably, if you fit in with the context, Mount Hermon fits, and it's actually a real mountain, but we don't know. All right, so then the Transfiguration comes in here. And what's the point of the Transfiguration? Actually, that's the next chapter, so we'll wait on that for a second. So we got the Caesarea Philippi, and we've got the Peter's thing, and then Stein, I should touch on this, I don't want to move too quickly past this. Stein explores just a little bit about the whole Petrine thing, right? You know, you are Peter and on this rock, and you're going to revisit that again in Systematics 4 when we talk about this, and probably again next quarter. So Stein, I think, does a pretty good job. He's trying to be fair. He's not a Roman Catholic. He's an evangelical. And yet, he's willing to say, there's something about Peter's position. He's the leader, no doubt about it. But to say he's exclusively that, no. And I think Stein's best counsel is, it's really pretty foolhardy to build an entire edifice of church structure on a single section of Scripture. And I think that's probably a good word of counsel. And I agree with him on that. So I think he handles this pretty well. Any other questions here on this chapter, on the Caesarea Philippi stuff, chapter 11, and why it's such a big deal? So the passion prediction is huge because Jesus immediately identifies his messiahship and his sonship with his activity, which is the cross and the suffering and death with the cross. It all belongs together. They can't be taken apart. And so this for him is just one piece of what exactly he's here to do. It all runs together. All right, then we're set up into the Transfiguration, which we're told is within a week after this, right on top of the Caesarea Philippi. And if you're thinking about it in context, then the Transfiguration is sort of like, yep, confirmation of exactly what you said. And so Peter, James, and John get taken along. They're there at the Transfiguration, and they get to see all the events. Stein has a decent discussion, I think, about why Moses and Elijah, and what are the reasons he offers. Yeah.
There was one place where those two were linked in, like, Ezekiel or something.
All right. So you have a common link in one prophet where you've got Moses and Moses and Elijah being pulled together. All right. That's one possible part of it. Weston.
Or possibly taking up.
All right. There is, around both Moses and Elijah, kind of mysterious stuff around their death. Elijah clear cut. We've got the chariots coming down and separating Elijah from Elisha. Then the whirlwind comes and takes Elijah up, and he's no more. And then Moses, he goes up onto the mountain, Mount Nebo, and he sees the promised land, and then God buries him. But nobody knows where his grave is. And, in fact, tradition then was that Moses was actually translated to heaven without being buried. Okay? This is what the tradition started to go around. And this shows up a little bit in Jude, where you've got the fight between Satan and the angels over Moses' body. All right? But you have this kind of situation where they were both taken up to heaven in kind of a weird way. All right? Then what's the third thing? The third reason?
The problem that it's not... that Jesus isn't Moses or one of the prophets.
All right. You have, in a sense, he's not simply one of the Moses of the prophets. There's that going on. But Moses and Elijah also are good representatives of essentially the whole Old Testament witness. Moses is the law. Elijah is the prophets. And then you might say, well, there's better prophets than Elijah. Yeah, but Elijah's the first, and he usually gets listed first as these prophets. So Moses and Elijah stand out. So when you take these things together, pretty good reason why you've got Moses and Elijah. The thing I've always wondered personally is how they knew it was Moses and Elijah, unless they were wearing their church, you know, name tag, you know. Hi, I'm Moses, you know. Oh, hey, Moses, you know, heard about you. Or maybe he looked like his photographs, you know. Again, we have trouble with this. But perhaps God, Jesus introduced them, you know. Hey, Peter, I want you to meet a couple guys here. Who knows? Or maybe they find out later, and Jesus tells them. So they know it's Moses and Elijah, and this is part of the vision. I think all this kind of plays in together here. That Moses certainly is the law. Elijah comes as a prophet. So we have the whole Old Testament kind of testimony. But then there is something, I think, also even to the, you know, they have bodies, perhaps. Because if Elijah's going to show up, well, Elijah's body is somewhere rotting still, waiting for the resurrection. And so he only has a soul. But Moses, maybe. And Elijah, for sure, has got a body. This is kind of interesting. So maybe that's part of the reason they're there. Again, we're into speculation land, but maybe there's something to this. All right, so then we have the word from the cloud. And Stein actually says there's a little bit of a twinge of rebuke to this. Why? Because Peter's making some wrong assumptions, right? Yeah, so believe him. Listen to him. Because, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say he puts Moses and Elijah on the same level.
Yes, this is exactly the problem. We have the problem that Peter is saying, hey, how about we make a couple shelters for the three of you guys? And he's equating Jesus with Moses and Elijah. And we're having this kind of idea that, oh, yeah, he is like Moses and Elijah. That's pretty cool. And the implication of, hey, this is my son. Listen to him. Now, quit listening to your ideas. Quit listening to the ideas of other people. Listen to what Jesus tells you and pay attention to what he tells you about his messiahship. Pay attention when he tells you about his suffering. Pay attention when he tells you about who I really am. And so it's the idea of you listen to him. And so there is this element of correction in this direction from the Father. And I think there's something to that. I would agree with that. All right, so we have the voice from heaven, and then from now on, Jesus is determined that he is going to head to Jerusalem, and he will not be deterred. This is it. He is on course for Jerusalem. All right, good. Anything else on the Transfiguration? Yep?
You just mentioned the making shelters. Stein mentioned something about making shelters in connection to a tabernacle.
Right. The word for shelter and the word for tabernacle and the word for tent are all the same. It's, and so you have this idea of this the tabernacle, this presence of God. And there is speculation by some this might have been around the time of the Festival of the Booths, and when we would build these shelters and you go out and hang out in the shelters. And so maybe Peter has that in mind. People have also said, no, Peter's problem is he's trying to prolong the experience. He doesn't want to go back down to the plain. We have a hymn about that. And he just wants to hang around there. So we're not really sure why. My tendency is, I tend to think, I now follow, I think it's Luke on this, one of the gospel writers says, Peter didn't know what to say. He was just talking. And to me, that's probably the best explanation. Peter's there, and this experience is just completely unnerving. You know, here's Jesus in all of his glory. Here's Moses and Elijah, and here's the three of them. What are we doing here? And it's just unnerving. And so what does Peter do? I got to get busy. I got to do something. How about we make some shelters for you guys? Okay, can we? How about that? And so I really think Peter's just talking to find something to do. And then, he's a man of action, and he's overwhelmed, and it's scaring him. And the best way to handle this is to do something. And I think that really accounts for what Peter's doing. I think his offer is not because it even makes sense. He's just trying to find something worthwhile to do. And that's my guess. And I guess my guess is as good as any other. But take the one you like. Yep.
I might be reading into this kind of after the fact, but could something be said if we take Moses being taken into heaven and then with Elijah and then Christ's ascension, these are like the three that were...
Well, you can maybe do something with that, but then you have to throw Enoch in there somewhere, and Enoch gets left out, unfortunately, because he's Genesis, so who cares? But homiletically, can you make those kinds of moves and play with it a little bit? Maybe so. Yeah, but I wouldn't push too hard on any of those things because we don't know for sure.
Yeah, fair enough.
All right?
Yeah.
Good. Now we're up to the triumphal entry. All right, chapter 13, Israel's king. This is the chapter that usually gets people kind of excited because the one section in here where Stein makes a suggestion about the donkey. So what'd you think of this? Yeah.
I mean, I guess just as we talked about Q the other day, it doesn't really matter.
All right.
But
you're making huge strides so quickly. This is good. No, yeah,
it was definitely intriguing to hear that he supposed that Jesus had established things and set things up.
All right. Now, so let's just walk through this a little bit. And the reason I want to spend a little time on this is because this is kind of a good test case for how we're doing our Christology, from above or from below. All right? Because from the time you're little kids, you've heard the story about Palm Sunday, and you hear about how Jesus is going up the hill, and he tells his disciples, hey, go on ahead. You're going to find a colt. Untie him. They're going to say to you, hey, why are you doing that? Just say, the Lord needs it, and they'll send him back here. And we have in mind, Jesus has his divine clicked on in his mind, and Jesus is kind of looking ahead. Oh, there it is. Okay, go get him. And that's how we operate. We make the assumption, right? Sign says, maybe not. Maybe not. Now, a little context here. Where is all this taking place? It's on the Mount of Olives. All right? So geographically, Mount of Olives is this kind of ridge that runs parallel to the Temple Mount, and you've got the Kidron Valley down in below. Right? So you would go down the Mount of Olives, through the Kidron Valley, then climb back up the Temple Mount into the Temple. So when you're on the Mount of Olives, you can look straight across the Kidron Valley, and there's the Temple Mount. Pretty spectacular. And that's why this also fits into the whole Olivet discourse, when Jesus is teaching his little apocalypse from that same position, and there's the Temple all laid out. Pretty cool. Garden of Gethsemane, where's that? Mount of Olives, somewhere on that same hillside. So this is where all these things are happening. Now, what's on the backside of that ridge? No one's certain, but the best guess is that's probably where Bethany and Bethphage were. Bethany is only about 2 miles from Jerusalem. In other words, up the top, down through the valley, and into Jerusalem. That's it. So that's where Bethany is. Who's in Bethany? Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. Right? Had Jesus been there before? John tells us, yes. This is the same Mary and Martha who had the whole sitting at Jesus' feet and one being too busy. That Mary. This is the same Mary who anoints Jesus and is rebuked by Judas and then is defended by Jesus. And the gospel writers tell us about this. And when did that event happen? Well, most scholars say probably before Palm Sunday. In fact, most scholars will put it, Lenski even does, on the Saturday night before a Palm Sunday entrance. And they're told that that event happened in the home of Simon the leper in Bethany. Now, who's Simon the leper? People guess again. Maybe that's the name of the father of Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. Or maybe it's a guy who had a big enough house to accommodate everybody who's at this little party for the 12 and for Lazarus, because Lazarus is there. Now, wait a minute. Let's back up even more. Lazarus. There's that story in John 11, right, where Lazarus is sick, and Mary and Martha tell Jesus, hey, your friend, the one who you love is sick. Come quick. Jesus says, Lazarus is sick. We're going to hang around here for a few more days. And then they go when he's dead. And this, don't forget this part. This is where Thomas says, all right, let's go. We'll go with him and die. Obviously, things had come to the point already at this stage that things are pretty hairy down there in Judea and in Jerusalem. And Thomas is not too crazy about going, but all right, Jesus is going to go. We'll go with him. So they go down, and Lazarus is raised. And that time, Jesus is not captured or imprisoned. And he departs again and comes back. But this is all obviously happening right around this same time period. So it's all in the spring of that same year. So Lazarus is raised, and we know also that after Lazarus had been raised, he was a little bit of kind of this cause celebre, right? People were coming out from Jerusalem to see the dead guy who's alive again. Maybe Mary and Martha were selling tickets, you know. Martha probably had some pies there for sale, you know. A little industry going here. We don't know, but we do know people were going out to see Lazarus, and he was quite the celebrity. So Jesus knew these people. He had spent time there. He had been there enough to raise Lazarus. He'd been there enough for this banquet. He'd been there to teach Mary and Martha. He knew this place. And there's even speculation that this was where he would stay when he was in Jerusalem, with Mary and Martha there in the house in Bethany, which makes perfect sense. This is where he would be. Now, having said all that, would Jesus have known some of the people around the area?
Sure.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is not so hard to imagine. So, Stein says, here's what maybe happened. So Jesus and his disciples arrive in Bethany on their way to Jerusalem. And they get there, who knows when exactly, but maybe, you know, the day before the Sabbath starts, because remember, Sabbath starts Friday night, and then you got for all day Friday night, Saturday all day, you rest on the Sabbath. Then Saturday night, sun goes down, we have the banquet. Next morning, you get up at Sunday morning, Palm Sunday. Well, somewhere in there, Jesus went out, did what he usually did, take a walk around, you know, see some people, and he walks up the hill, and he meets one of his old friends and says, hey, Sunday morning, I'm going to be coming up here with my disciples, and I'm going to be entering Jerusalem, and I want to do it on a donkey. You see, you got one over there. New one hasn't been ridden. Can I borrow it for the morning? You'll get it back. Don't worry. Can I borrow it for the morning? And they say, Jesus, whatever you want. No problem. Sure. Go ahead. So he just says, okay, good. See you then. So then he walks back to Bethany, and we're all set. Sunday morning comes, and he says to Peter and John, hey, there's a donkey up there waiting. Go get it. And they go get it. Now, is that feasible? Absolutely. Is anything detracted from Jesus by telling the story that way? No. In fact, I would even argue maybe something is gained. What could you argue is even gained by telling the story that way? Jesus is intentionally planning it. It's a determined, intentional thing because he is going to make a statement. It's the time to come into Jerusalem riding on a donkey. Zechariah is in his mind, and he is doing messianic things, and he knows it. So in other words, he's being deliberate about it. It's carefully crafted. Now you might say, that sounds like Jesus is being sneaky. There's nothing sneaky here. He's not like he's telling his disciples, like, I think there's a donkey up there. Go get it. And he's not being tricky or, you know, crafty, like, you know, a little underhanded. He's just saying, hey, there's a donkey up there. Go get it. And the disciples say, all right, let's go. So it all works out? Yep, just like he said. So does it have to be divine, you know, understanding? Not necessarily. Now, it could have been. And I'm not knocking that. Can Jesus predict things? Duh, he's God. Of course. This is a non-issue. But the point is, could he have done it from a purely human standpoint? Yes. And the reason this is kind of a useful test case is we have this tendency in our piety from above to immediately hear a story and go to the God explanation every time. Wow, yeah, that's the God thing. That's the God thing. Well, maybe not. Maybe there's just the human thing going on. And can it be either one? Maybe it could be. We don't know for sure. It's all right. Either one works. But even to say that Jesus is intentionally, deliberately doing this, he clearly is, but to even say he prearranges it, I don't think that detracts from it. I think it actually adds to it in some ways. All right, now you can be totally unconvinced by this and not like it. That's fine. But that's kind of where Dinah's going with this whole thing. All right. Any other questions there or discussion there? John, go ahead.
Well, just playing devil's advocate, you said, I think, on day one in here about the miracle of feeding 5,000, uh-huh. Some believe that Jesus
right.
Is. What's the difference?
Oh, the difference is because the miracle of the 5,000, you've got the saying that Jesus is producing these loaves. And so this is the way it's being told in the synoptics that
Jesus
it's this going on.
Jesus doesn't say that. He doesn't say that.
Well, true enough. I suppose that's fair enough. You can do that, I guess. But he also tells them later on, you know, you're here because of the loaves and the fish, and he kind of chides them for this. And so clearly the disciples interpreted this as a miraculous event and not as something else, and it was being told that way. So I think that would be the difference. I'm just saying that there's nothing around this event that says this was a miraculous thing, that Jesus was knowing this. It's just there. See, we get the same kind of thing also when you've got Jesus who's praying on the mountain, and he sees his disciples in distress on the Sea of Galilee, and then he goes to them walking on the water, right? But the question is, well, how did he see them? Well, he's high enough up, he could see them. And the other answer is, he's God, he can see everything. Well, which one is it? It doesn't really matter. It could go either way. Okay, I think that's all I'm trying to say about this one. All right, good. So we have that prearranged possibility. The point of the palms is the royalty aspect of this. And then we have also the comment that Stein makes is how big of an impact would this event have made on all of Jerusalem? Yeah, Stein says negligible. And why? You say, no, wait a minute. No. This is like the big event. And the argument Stein makes is maybe not so much, because Jerusalem's already packed with pilgrims. You've got people coming into town all the time, and you've got people who are big shots coming in for the Passover. And so, yeah, the fact that Jesus, who everybody's been hearing about, is here in Jerusalem, yeah, that caused a stir, but probably kind of localized. It's not like they were sending out a Twitter notice and then a flash mob formed, or that they were, you know, putting out, you know, a PR release, tomorrow, 10 o'clock, be on the Mount of Olives, something's going to come down. You know, it just happened. And so if you happen to be there, wow, pretty cool. But it's not like, you know, everybody was planning for this. And so it happened, and Jesus is in, and you have the rebuke from the Pharisees. But after that, it kind of just all kind of backs down and dies down. And what is interesting is Stein points out that we don't have any record of this specific event being used as evidence against Jesus at his trial. Now, maybe that's another argument from silence, and it is, because we're told that they made charges against Jesus, but we're not specified what they are except for the one about the temple being destroyed. Other than that, we're kind of left in the dark. So we can't overplay that too much, but the fact is, maybe it wasn't that big a deal for a lot of the people. Now, for the disciples, big deal. Jesus is making the claim. For Jesus himself, big deal. And it's like I said, again, he's not hiding anything anymore. He's taking the titles. He's taking the claim. He's doing the actions. He's Messiah, and it's got in the open.
Didn't they? I thought I read that they not often, but at least on occasion, would make a big deal out of a pilgrim coming into Jerusalem. So Jesus coming into Jerusalem as a pilgrim,
welcoming a pilgrim,
wasn't any big deal.
Well, the whole festive nature of this is pretty heavy. I mean, the Passover time is an upbeat time. You're singing the Hallel Psalms, and you're welcoming pilgrims, and everybody's coming. So, yeah, the whole thing is kind of festive anyway. And it wasn't that unusual, especially for somebody really special, to welcome him in a special way. Yep.
So kind of going right off that, would his entry and that welcoming be just kind of a stereotypical welcome that people would get? Or was
perhaps,
it,
but there's more, because you've got the Hosanna calls, you know, save us.
So it was recognizable that you know,
there's
Jesus
more.
Welcomed, it was something extra.
That's right. It's kind of a normal thing, but then pumped up with a whole lot more meaning.
Sure.
Exactly. So it's not just that. There's more going on.
Related to Stein's view of prophecy, I'm curious with this, because we usually say, okay, he seems to operate with the idea that prophecy is kind of this retroactive thing. Mm. Like Matthew said, oh, well, this was...
Oh, that's some of
this.
It. Some
so
of
why
it.
Would Jesus pick a donkey?
Well, yeah, because he points out that Zechariah was not, you know, latently in everybody, wasn't in the forefront of people's minds that you have to fulfill this. But it does fulfill it. And it's getting one of those things where Jesus even maybe is saying, yeah, this is a messianic prophecy. Maybe no one's picking up on it, but it is, and I'm going to fulfill even that prophecy.
So Jesus understood
sure.
the passage in Zechariah as a messianic prophecy.
I would say yes.
Even if everyone else
did not. Right.
But I guess my question is, it seems that people respond as if they understood it as a messianic prophecy by the Hosanna.
Maybe, but see, maybe it's not the donkey as much as it's Jesus. Because Jesus has spent a year and a half, 3 years establishing himself. People are coming to the conclusion he's the real deal. And they're seeing the prophet, they're seeing the miracles, they're hearing the teaching, they're catching on. I mean, all the actions, the titles, the words, they're getting it. And so there are plenty of people. The 12 aren't the only believers. I mean, there's this disciples who believe, and there are probably other people too, and they get caught up in the frenzy of it. So here he comes. He is the Messiah. And it's not so much like the donkey is screaming it. Ah, he's on the donkey. Messiah, as much as this is Jesus. He's the Messiah. And yeah, he is on a donkey. But so maybe that's not even the big deal to them. It's more like this is Jesus, finally here in Jerusalem. Yes, at last. We've been waiting for this. And they had been. A lot of people had been.
I just find it interesting because we take so much of this stuff for granted usually.
Correct.
That when we take a step back and look at it from below, it's a totally, radically different world.
I agree. That's kind of the fun in it. At least I think it's fun, but maybe you don't.
If you agree with that.
Yeah. All right.
Well, he also made the statement that Hosanna had lost its meaning of save.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of a general greeting.
Generic term,
yeah,
and maybe so. But then again, when you're addressing it to Jesus, it probably has overtones. Maybe this is the real thing now. You know, yeah. All right, finally, chapter 14, cleansing of the temple. What's the biggest issue we have to face here? Just on sheer chronology and sheer gospel interpretation. All right, we've got John telling us that the cleansing of the temple happened in chapter 2 of his gospel, right up front. One of the first things Jesus does, and in the synoptics, clearly it's happening Holy Week. It's Passion Week. And so now we have a problem. How does Stein want to solve it?
The literary device used by John.
One cleansing, John moves it to the front for his purposes. Okay? That's how Stein does it. How do other people solve it?
Two cleansings.
And that's how Lenski solves it. And there are others, you know, in the conservative bandhoods on the conservative side who would solve it that way. Two cleansings. Now, you can argue it and go around and around and try to sort this out. Stein says there are lots of similarities, and Lenski says there are lots of differences, and they're both right. But, you know, to be honest, the similarities between the two accounts kind of are what you would expect. If Jesus is going to drive out the people who aren't supposed to be there, it's going to be money changers and people selling sacrificial animals, right? And they'll probably be the same people there in John's gospel up front as they would be in the last week of his ministry. So that's probably not a surprise that there are similarities. The differences are significant because in John's gospel, you've got this whip of cords, and then you've got the prophecy of destroy this temple and in 3 days build another one not made with human hands. And neither of those things are mentioned in any of the synoptics. So I personally tend to come down on two cleansings. And I don't think that's that big of a deal for Jesus to do it once at the beginning and then once again at the end. And to be, you know, Jesus probably delivered lots of his parables more than once, or even his actions more than once. So I don't think that's that far-fetched. I think there could be two cleansings. Yeah.
Well, with John having a more artistic and poetic side to how he told the story.
True.
Could it be possible that it could be the same cleansing, but John just decides to put it, for whatever reason, before I guess the Passion account to kind of give a Quentin Tarantino style of telling the story?
Again, you're right. This is in Stein's case. You know, this would not be that unusual for John to do something like that, to rearrange it. And as I mentioned before, chronology was not that big a deal to these gospel writers. They weren't that hung up on the exact dating of things. They were more worried about getting the message straight. And so that's certainly possible. So it really doesn't matter where you come down on this either way. I don't think it's a huge issue of faith.
Not arguing issue of faith, but mm-hmm. just curiosity from argument of silence, mm-hmm. I guess, would be if there were two cleansings when he went during Holy Week, wouldn't there be some kind of reference to I wonder what he'll do?
Well, I think there was this kind of, you know, everybody was always kind of waiting to see what Jesus is going to do. He would surprise people all the time. You know, he would heal people on the Temple Mount. He had done that. He would teach there. So the there was this kind of anticipation. And as you read the Gospels, you know, Holy Week, Jesus had this, spent all day Tuesday, this day of confrontation, kind of going toe-to-toe with the Pharisees and with scribes and with, you know, the Sadducees, Sanhedrin representatives basically taking him on. So you have this kind of sense of, and people kind of watching to see. It's also interesting, we're almost out of time here, but Stein makes the point that, you know, maybe this was even a localized cleansing. It wasn't, you know, temple-wide. And if you know a little bit about the temple, you know, this is a big place, you know, huge area, 3 football fields long, all right? It's enormous, huge, huge place. And so, you know, for Jesus to be able to cleanse the entire temple and have control of it, he'd probably obviously have to have people who would be complicit with him and kind of going along with it. Or, and maybe that's possible. You know, I'm cool with that. Or maybe it was just kind of a corner or section of the temple that he did this, and it was more making a point. Either way, you know, it doesn't detract from it either way, as far as you get the message of Jesus is in control of this, and he's making the clear point, this is my temple.
He was out of the area that he cleaned would have been the woman's.
Would have been the court of the Gentiles, actually.
The Gentiles, outside of the woman's.
That's right. That's right. Yep. Because that would be the place where they do the business and the selling and stuff. That would be where it would go on. All right, then we have the cursing of the fig tree, one of Mark's great little sandwiches, where you have the fig tree cursed and then the cleansing, and then you have the fig tree all dried up, and everybody says, poor fig tree. It wasn't even the right season. And the point, of course, is Jesus is doing this to make a message. It's a lived-out parable. It's a parable in action. It's an allegory in action. And it's okay, because Jesus made the fig tree, and he can kill it when he wants. And it's all right. Yeah, right. He'll make it better at the eschaton. All right, good. Anything else in chapter 11 then, or chapter 14 on the cleansing of the temple? All right, now, for next time, we're going to leave Stein behind. Stein goes on and he finishes all the way through the ascension. To be honest, I think Stein goes a little downhill. He gets a little bit preachy and a little devotional and a little bit evangelical, and some of the sharpness of his arguments aren't quite as there, and maybe the insights aren't as sharp. I don't know if he was running up hard on the deadline, maybe, or I don't know, he just got worn out. Who knows? Or maybe I'm just jaded and I don't think he does a good job with it. But we're going to leave Stein. And next time we're going to take up Metaxas, and I want you to read the whole thing. It reads quickly, and you should be able to crank through it without too much trouble, but get going on it. And I have multiple reasons for doing Metaxas, and we'll talk about that next time. So I just want you to let him lead you along and see where it goes. See you next time.